Dollar. This is Louis Dollar. It's so nice to have you back where you belong. You looking swell, Dollar. I can't tell, Dollar.
Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to have a wonderful hour. The author of Pops is with us, A Life of Louis Armstrong. Terry Teachout is our guest. Terry is the drama critic for the Wall Street Journal and the chief culture critic of Commentary, the author of a number of other books, including All in the Dance, A Brief Life of George Balanchine, The Skeptic, A Life of H.L. Mencken, and other books. He's also a musician. He worked as a jazz bassist before becoming a full-time writer and has contributed to the Oxford Companion to Jazz. He's written liner notes, and we're happy to have him with us this hour. This book is just extraordinary. I didn't realize the complexity of Louis Armstrong until I read it yesterday. Of course, considered the greatest jazz musician of the 20th century and a giant of modern American culture. He said about, because he's also, this book looks at a number of race issues from the early 1900s until when he died. And Louis Armstrong said he had his own ideas about racial segregation and spent half of his life breaking down barriers through positive action and not a lot of words. I don't socialize with a top dog society after a dance or concert, he said. Even though I'm invited, I don't go. These same people may go around the corner and lynch a Negro, but while they're listening to our music, they don't think about trouble. And what's more, they're watching Negro and white musicians play side by side. We're going to talk about Louis Armstrong. He called himself Louis, so we'll call him Louis. He said white people used to call him Louis. And I guess I have a white person, so I call him Louis, just that's why. But this hour, I will actually, forevermore, I will call him Louis Armstrong. So our guest is joining us by phone today, Terry Teachout. Hi, Terry. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write beautifully as well, but what an incredibly captivating life this man had. It is just unbelievable what he was able to do.
Well, that's the success of the book. I mean, I don't know whether the book is any good or not, but it's such a great story that you really can't go wrong when you're writing a book about Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm. I think the book is pretty good, too. Really, I think you do just a fine job. I had no idea that he grew up in such a wild kind of circumstance, with his mother a part-time prostitute, his dad left him when he was born. The kid really was fending for himself until he got put in a kind of a reformatory, actually. He really was taking care of himself and everybody else.
Yeah, and he was doing this in the roughest neighborhood of New Orleans, born there in 1901 on a block that was known in New Orleans as the Battleground, because it was the home of pimps and prostitutes and gamblers and thugs and, every kind of rough cat. And this young boy was brought up, born in a one-room shack, right in the middle of all this craziness. And then he grows up and becomes Louis Armstrong, the great genius of jazz. It's one of the most unlikely and, I think, miraculous stories in American art and culture.
It sure is. Tell me about, and this was an important time when he had the gun that had blanks in it, and where he wound up subsequently as a result of his action, which really led him to not only an appreciation of music, but where he started to develop his genius.
Yeah, he was 11, 12 years old, and it was New Year's Eve in New Orleans, a time when everybody wants to make as much noise as possible. So Little Louis, which is what everybody called him, borrowed a six-shooter from one of his stepfathers, as he referred to his mother's part-time companions, and loaded it up with blanks, went out on the street, and a kid comes running up to him and shoots him with a cap pistol. And Armstrong decides he's going to up the ante, and he shoots back with blanks. And all of a sudden, he's got a policeman right on top of him, and they brought him in and sentenced him to an indefinite term in what was called the Colored Waifs Home of New Orleans.
Goodness.
Which was the reform school for young black male children.
The Colored Waifs Home. And it was at this point that he learned how to play the horn.
Yeah, he had a cornet. He bought a used cornet from a pawn shop, and he'd been playing around with it. I think he knew how to play Home Sweet Home. But it was in the Waif's home that he got his first real training, and his only real training, as a matter of fact, on the instrument, learned how to read music, took to it immediately, and very quickly became the first cornet player of the Waif's home brass band. That was where he first heard classical music. That was where he first played spirituals. The way he put it late in life was, me and music got married at the Waif's home. I don't think you could put it any better than that.
Me and music got married. You talk about the fact that he used to warm up playing tunes from one of his favorite Italian operas. Did he learn those operas at that home?
A little bit later, he played selections, classical selections, at the Waif's home. And then when he was a teenager, he bought his first phonograph, a wind-up Victrola, back in those old days. And New Orleans, we often forget or don't realize, was not just a jazz culture, but it also had a highly developed opera culture, French opera. And Armstrong heard opera in New Orleans, and among the first records he bought, he tells us this, not only did he buy the original Dixieland Jazz Band playing Tiger Rag, but he bought records by Caruso and John McCormick, Luisa Tetrazzini, and this music, it didn't just stay with him, but he loved it and listened to it all of his life. And a little later on, when he went up to Chicago, and he was playing in the Movie House Orchestra, one of his big featured numbers was the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana, and
oh my gosh,
the tune that he liked to warm up on.
Oh, my goodness. When did he know he could sing?
He always sang. He sang even before he played. Sang out on the streets when he was a little boy. He put together a kind of a barbershop quartet. They would roam up and down the streets of Storyville, the red light district of New Orleans, and they would sing for pennies. And believe me, in 1910, singing for pennies was a big deal. If you came home with a hat full of pennies, you put food on the table for a week.
And he was putting a lot of food on the table. He was playing, and he was also working full-time. He had this incredible sense of responsibility, didn't he, of taking care of his mom, taking care of his mother's sister's second cousin who he adopted?
Yeah, I can't quite figure out the exact description of the relationship, but when Armstrong was a teenager, he made himself responsible for and eventually adopted this distant relation whose mother had died. The boy had an accident later on and had mental problems for the rest of his life, and Armstrong never turned his back on him. He took care of Clarence, that was the boy's name, to the end of his own life and beyond. He arranged for his care. That sense of responsibility is, I think, one of the most striking features of his personality, because it's present right from the beginning. He said he got it from his mother, and obviously he learned it at the Waif's home, which was run like a military school. And it was what made the difference for him, because the world is full of talented people who never do anything with it. But Louis Armstrong did everything with his talent, everything that there was in him to do. And it was the sense of responsibility coupled with the genius that made him the great culture-changing figure of jazz.
Yes. Coupled with this, what you call know that I'm there in the cause of happiness.
Yeah, yeah. He was a fundamentally optimistic character. Somewhere in the book I call him a major key.
I like that.
I think it's exactly right. I mean, look, he's not naive. He's seen everything.
Right.
You know, he grew up in the battleground. He's seen throughout well into his adult life. He experiences every kind of manifestation of prejudice that there is in the world. And he's realistic about it, but also he doesn't let it bow him down. He insists throughout his life that the glass is at least half full and that through his own effort, he can make his life and maybe even the world a better place, and he turned out to be right.
Mm-hmm. Where did he get this criticism, and how widespread was the criticism that he was a clown for white audiences, that he was an Uncle Tom?
Well, the first traces of it really began when he played in England in the early 30s. They really had never seen anybody like him, and some of those stuffy, stiff upper lip types wrote some very sniffish pieces about him. But the criticism really made its way into the public discourse after World War II. you had a generational shift. Remember, Armstrong is part of that first generation of well-known jazz musicians. Well, the ones that came after him, the younger beboppers, particularly Dizzy Gillespie, who was the point man of this criticism, they saw themselves not as entertainers, but as artists, and they wanted to be treated as artists. And the sense of black pride in what it consists was changing with the times as well. So Gillespie and other players of his generation found Armstrong's very expansive, comical demeanor as an onstage musician to be embarrassing, and they knocked him on it in print. Gillespie actually called him an Uncle Tom, which is just not true. Armstrong was nothing like that. He was what he was, a man born in 1901, raised in the vaudeville tradition and raised with minstrel shows, who, like every other black man and black musician of his generation, found this kind of humor. It was simply something he'd grown up with.
Right.
Gillespie lived long enough to change his tune. In his autobiography, written a couple of years before his death, he retracted all of the criticism that he made against Armstrong, said that he'd just been wrong about it. And in a very striking phrase, he says, "Hell, I had my own way of Tom." And he and Armstrong made it up long before Armstrong's death. But Armstrong was very hurt by this criticism when it was happening, because he knew it was not true, that an injustice was being done to him. And he was vexed about it.
The other thing, it's so nice in this field when you get really genuine people who are very, very smart and very well known, and you feel like you've known them forever and they don't have airs about them. And as a result, they can share what they're really thinking about things. Louis Armstrong, as you write, was known as much for his genuineness, and what a nice high compliment that is, as he was for his genius.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And he is what he seems to be. Mm-hmm. Now, in private, he's a more complicated person. I mean, what genius is not? But the complications don't change his essential nature. And when he went on stage, that great smile and the happiness that he exuded, they're real. They're not something that he was putting on for the paying customers. It's the real thing. And you can feel that. Now, I realize that there are people who can simulate genuineness, but believe me, I've now been close enough to Armstrong through my work to know that he wasn't one of those folks. He told you what he was thinking, and he showed you what he was feeling, and it was real.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong, and the author is our guest. It really is a very, very well-done book. It is totally captivating, and it's, as Terry said, it's partially the life of Louis Armstrong. If you do your job, he's a great person to have as your subject matter. But Terry's also a wonderful writer as well. He's the drama critic of the Wall Street Journal and the chief culture critic of Commentary. And he's also a musician, which makes a difference, I think, when you're writing about somebody like Armstrong. Well, welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night? And I know I'm not wrong. The feeling's getting stronger the longer I stay away.
The author of Pops is our guest, and we're talking about the life of Louis Armstrong. I absolutely love that song, and I would imagine you do as well. And it's great to listen to it after having read your book, because a lot of the book is New Orleans. A lot of Louis Armstrong was New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, although he left there when he was 22 and never lived there again, this was the place where he became himself. And although, again, he had very complicated feelings about the city and about the race relations there, he still always loved it and cherished the memories and wrote about them very beautifully in his own autobiography, Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, one of the best books ever written about jazz.
Let's spend some time on race relations, because he lived through so many big times in race relations. He has written that he felt that he's always done great things about uplifting my race. What does he mean by that?
Well, Well, if you just go down the record of his achievements and you don't look at anything else, you are looking here at the man who was the first black person to receive star billing in a mixed-cast Hollywood movie, the first black person to host a variety show on radio, his own show. He broke down all kinds of barriers in the entertainment world, was one of the very first black entertainers to successfully insist that he be allowed to stay in the hotels where his band was playing. From 1947 on, he always led an integrated band, and he took that band down south when it was quite the big deal to put a mixed band on stage. He played one gig down south where a Ku Klux Klan guy drove by this performance and threw a stick of dynamite at the front door of the auditorium, which didn't faze Armstrong a bit. He heard the explosion, and, of course, the audience is terrified. He just looks out at the crowd, grins, and says, "That's all right, folks. It's just the phone."
It's just the phone. The guy has seen it all, right? I mean, the guy has seen it
really
all.
He really had seen everything.
Right. What about the guy?
His life had been put at risk. I mean, once the whole band was back in the 30s, was thrown in jail in Memphis because they had a white road manager. This was when the big band was all black. And the police said, "Look, we need some more cotton pickers down here." The only way they got out was they agreed to play a benefit for the Memphis Police Department.
Oh, my gosh. What about the guy he met, and I'm wondering if this happened very often. I think it was in Lubbock, Texas.
Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah, tell us about that meeting.
Well, it's an amazing story. Armstrong tells it very explicitly, and it has an important place in my book. He's playing down in Lubbock, and this guy comes backstage, and to tell the story, I have to use the word, and the guy says to him, "I don't like niggers." So he's saying this to Louis Armstrong in an all-black band. And there are two guys with him who are about to pull knives on this guy.
Ooh.
And Armstrong stops him. He says, no, Pops, you tell us, what is it that you don't like about us?" And the guy suddenly bursts out in tears. He has no answer. And the amazing end of the story, as Armstrong tells us, is that the man and his family became lifelong friends of Armstrong.
Oh my.
And every time that the band would come through, they'd have him over to dinner. You know?
I love that story.
Louis Armstrong as anything else, that he had this kind of openness that I think really could change people.
Right.
I know that he changed people because I come from, not the Deep South, but
Missouri.
Right. My father witnessed a lynching, the first part of a lynching. That was the kind of place it was, and I remember separate entrances. And yet Armstrong really was, for many people back then, back there, I think the first black person that they ever really came to respect and eventually to love. And an experience like that cannot help but change your consciousness. I know that it did.
Let's go to some phone calls. Mary from Waukon, Iowa is our first caller. Hey, Mary.
Hi. I read a biography of, I read his memoirs, and then I read a biography of Bing Crosby. And in that, he talks quite a bit about Armstrong and how he kind of brought him to the national forefront. Is that true?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear everything that was being said. He blossomed through what?
Bing Crosby brought him to the national forefront.
Yes. Well, I talk a lot about the relationship between Crosby and Armstrong in this book because it's a very, very important aspect of both their lives. They were mutually influential musically to begin with. Crosby said more than once that I love the way he put it. He said that Armstrong was the beginning and end of American music. And it was really Armstrong who taught Crosby how to swing. Conversely, though, Crosby taught Armstrong how to sing a ballad effectively in jazz style. They loved each other. They worked together often on the radio. And it was Bing Crosby who gave Armstrong that big break in Hollywood because Crosby was producing a movie, A Pennies from Heaven, in 36. And he said to the studio, "I don't do this film unless you let me hire Armstrong and unless you let me give him equal billing with me about the title." So, yes, it's true. They were close. It was important to both of them. And Crosby really opened the door to a wider kind of startup for Armstrong.
And yet, you do mention, and I wonder why you do, Crosby never had him over to his house.
Well, I realized after the book was in print that I should have put in one more sentence to make it a little clearer, because it's true, but Bing Crosby was a strange man. He didn't have any colleagues over. He did not socialize with the people with whom he worked. He was very careful and self-protective. So it wasn't simply Armstrong, and I don't think it was in any way a racial thing. I think it was just that he drew this line between his private and public lives. And Armstrong, who didn't realize this, as much as he loved and admired Crosby, he was genuinely puzzled by this and mentions it in a piece he once wrote for Ebony about race relations. I wish Armstrong had known that Crosby was a kind of a strange man this way.
Thanks very much, Mary, for your call. We go next to Edgar from Racine. Hi, Edgar.
Yes, hi. I would like to thank the author, first of all, for making a great biography of a great great American legend.
Thank you very much for your kind words.
I really appreciate it. And second, I would like to ask you, if you know directly within the community that Lewis might have spent the most amount of time with as a young child, within the parameters available to him at the time, not looking to compare him because you cannot compare, what effect did he have on his immediate community? Was it available for artists to make an impact on their immediate community, their immediate surroundings, or was his power so much as a national cultural movement?
Well, look, Armstrong, as I said a little earlier, left New Orleans in 1922 when he was 21 years old. The world of jazz in New Orleans was still a fairly small one, a relatively small neighborhood, so to speak. Within the compass of that world, everybody knew him. He was playing in brass bands. He, although still a young man, was coming to be seen as one of the very best trumpet players in New Orleans. But when he left. And from that point on, he had the same influence on people in New Orleans that he did on people in the rest of the world. You know, they bought his records, they listened to him, they were thrilled by him and admired him. And, of course, in New Orleans, he was seen as the hometown boy made good. When he came back to New Orleans, he left at 22, and he came back for his first visit in 31. And he nearly caused a riot when he got off the train. Three brass bands, and the streets were crowded. And, you know, everybody was astonished.
Oh, I wish he could be there this weekend, don't you?
Oh, gosh, yes.
What a time they'd all have. What a time.
Yeah, not kidding.
We should talk about his time in Chicago, because you paint this wonderful picture of, I can't remember the name of the club in Chicago where everybody went to dance, and his reputation had preceded him to Chicago. And yet there's a little bit of jealousy, and I'm the top dog in some of these bands, and he wasn't allowed to play as he could really play because somebody else was first on the billing.
Right. Well, he was brought to Chicago by his New Orleans mentor, Joe Oliver, who had moved to Chicago and started the band that we now know as King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, which was the first black jazz band to record extensively, and it was the band with which Armstrong made his own first recordings. Armstrong was brought up to play second cornet to Oliver, who was an older man. And Oliver was approaching middle age, and his own powers were failing. And as much as he loved and believed in the talent of his young protege, he wasn't going to let him play first fiddle, so to speak. And Armstrong's then wife, Lil Armstrong, persuaded him that he had to move on, that if he was going to realize his own powers, he was going to have to be the first fiddler. And so Armstrong left the band and became Louis Armstrong after that. But he loved Oliver. He loved playing in that group. And the recordings they made tell us why he loved it, because it was one of the great bands of early jazz. And he loved Chicago, because he'd never been any place like that. New Orleans was not a small town, but it was also not Chicago. I mean, he comes to a place with skyscrapers and gangsters and people getting gunned down on the street corners, and he was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. had his first bath in an indoor tub in Chicago.
Isn't that something? Yeah.
Yeah. He'd always had to bathe in a galvanized wash tin out back in the alley, and he comes to Chicago, and there's a bathtub, you know, and
wow.
the landlady draws a bath for
wow.
him. So he was thrilled by that.
And it's also an interesting time in American history because you're getting this great migration of African Americans from the South to places like Chicago and also Milwaukee.
Yes. Armstrong's move north is part of what historians now call the Great Migration of blacks from the deep South to the North. It comes to that pivotal moment in black history, and it was the Great Migration that stimulated the explosion of jazz in Chicago that made that city one of the great historical centers of early jazz. And, of course, Armstrong also got himself wrapped up in what we call the Roaring Twenties. He worked for Al Capone, played in Capone's clubs. And very amusingly describes Capone as this nice, this cute little fat boy who looked like a school teacher. That was his memory of Al Capone.
Wow. My uncle used to fix Al Capone's car, too. I wish I had heard more stories about that when he was with us.
Wow.
Yeah. Thanks, Edgar, very much for the call. We go next to Mamadou from Sun Prairie. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, you guys. Yes, I'm from Africa, Mali, and I remember when I was much younger, my dad used to listen a lot of Louis Armstrong music. And my question will be, what was Louis Armstrong's relationship with the African music and his African roots? And if he ever went to Africa, you know, I would like to know.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. He didn't know anything about African music until he went to Africa for the first time. In 55 or 56, but CBS sent him and a camera crew there. They were doing a big documentary about him. Ed Murrow was doing a show about him, and so they sent him to Ghana, and he was mobbed. Of course, everybody in the world knew about Armstrong, and so he gets off the plane, and I think he played for an audience of 100,000 people. And thereafter returned as often as he could to Africa because he felt immediately the sense of kinship with the place from which his ancestors had come. And it was a very powerful emotional experience for him in the middle of his life. He was in his 50s when he had this experience. And he talks about it a lot in interviews. And the photographs of him playing for these audiences, it just tears at your heart to see the still photos of the film. There's an amazing film clip that the Murrow crew took of him playing one of his trademark numbers, What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue?
Oh, yes.
For a crowd of black Africans.
Oh.
Boy, if that doesn't get you, nothing will get you.
Oh, that song, yeah, I'll have to listen to him play that. That song always gets me. You start the book, actually, too, with this huge media thing that's happening because he's playing with the Philharmonic the first time he's played with them, and he's even cooler, I think, than Leonard Bernstein.
And completely.
He is, huh? And Bernstein was pretty darn cool, if you ask me. Yeah.
Well, I found a photograph of their meeting for the first time at their first rehearsal. And I talked to somebody who was at the rehearsal, George Avakian, who was recording the concert. And George told me that Armstrong comes strolling out in front of Bernstein and the orchestra. And he shakes his hand and he says, "Hello, Daddy." And everybody in the orchestra just broke up. And at that moment, somebody took a photograph. And in this picture, you can see every face on the musicians of the New York Philharmonic, who are a very tough bunch of customers. They're just all grinning like fools.
And Murrow doesn't know very much about jazz, but they're doing... Talk about this media event that takes place, because it helps to establish Louis Armstrong's dominant position as the master of jazz in the country.
Yeah, it was very touching, actually. Murrow, this was when his program See It Now was on, and he wanted to do a segment on Murrow. On Armstrong, and they filmed him in Africa, and they also filmed him touring Europe as a kind of unofficial ambassador of jazz. And there's a sequence in which Murrow is interviewing Armstrong backstage at a Paris nightclub, and it's just charming because you can see that Murrow knew absolutely nothing about jazz, and he's asking Armstrong to define gut bucket music and ask what a cat is, and Armstrong, who obviously is well aware of Murrow and has listened to him on the air many times, does a little imitation of Murrow as a hipster saying, come back and dig Murrow tomorrow. And, you know, it's just wonderful to watch this.
Oh, yeah, it'd be wonderful to see that again. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, Mamadou? No. Okay. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@WPR.org. We're talking with the author of Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. Terry Teachout is our guest this hour. Let's talk about his, because he sometimes had some pretty dramatic things to say about race relations, and I'd like for you to tell the story of the encounter he had with Dwight Eisenhower.
That is a great story.
It is.
I am the first person to be able to tell it.
Oh, really?
Complete detail. Armstrong was, well, we have to sketch the background for those who don't remember the details. Orville Faubus, who was then the governor of Arkansas, in 57, refused to cooperate with the ordered desegregation of the Little Rock public schools. And Dwight Eisenhower, the president, hesitated in taking action to enforce the Supreme Court decision. At this exact moment, Armstrong is playing in, I think it's Grand Forks, North Dakota, and a Cub reporter named Larry Lubinow, it's his first big assignment, talks the editor of the paper into letting him go interview Armstrong. So Armstrong's staying at the biggest hotel in town, and Lubinow talks the room service waiter into letting him bring up Armstrong's dinner. So Lubinow puts on the white jacket, brings up the dishes, comes through the door, and then immediately admits what he did, and Armstrong was absolutely charmed by this. So they sit down and chat. But then Lubinow mentions Little Rock. And Armstrong, who had never been asked about this by a reporter and who obviously was following the story very closely, exploded, not at Lubinow, but at President Eisenhower, and said in language that I cannot even begin to use on this radio program, that Eisenhower was doing the wrong thing. He called him gutless and two-faced, and used a word to describe Faubus, which would melt your radio circuits, if I were to quote it. So here's this kid reporter who has got the story of the year, but he can't print it because of the language. So he explains this to Armstrong, who again is quite amused, and they come up with various euphemisms. They quoted him calling Faubus an uneducated plowboy, which is not what Armstrong said.
No.
So Lubinow, whom I spoke to, that's how I got the details about this, goes back to the newspaper, writes up the story, editor takes one look at it, said, no way, I don't believe a word of this. So the next morning, Lubinow goes back to Armstrong's hotel with the story and with a photographer. And he shows Armstrong the story, Armstrong reads it, and he just scrawls one word at the top of the copy, solid, and then signs it. And the photographer takes a picture of the two of them together. Lubinow goes back to the newspaper. This time they printed it, and it went up on the wires. And it was in every newspaper in the United States the next morning. It was on the network news the next evening. And a week later, President Eisenhower sent the U.S. Army into Little Rock to desegregate the schools.
Prodded by Armstrong?
No way to know. No way to know, but they did happen one after the other, so you are invited to draw your own conclusions. And Armstrong, who was delighted, sent a telegram to Eisenhower congratulating him for what he'd done, and this telegram is in the Eisenhower Presidential Archive.
And he calls him Daddy, doesn't he?
Daddy. Well, he called everybody Daddy. Daddy or Pops. It's a very funny telegram. I quoted verbatim in the book. Armstrong had the unusual gift among people who are not professional writers of being able to write the way he talked. And when he sends a telegram or writes a personal letter or writes an article, he sounds like himself.
We'll take more phone calls in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Terry Teachout is our guest. His wonderful book is Pops, A Life of Louis Armstrong. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. Talk about the life of Louis Armstrong, and I'm reminded of earlier parts in your book when you have Louis playing that song as he is accompanying bodies to funerals in New Orleans when he's just a kid, right?
That's right. And he was, later on, the first jazz musician ever to make a jazz recording of When the Saints Go Marching In 1938. He would have recorded it a lot earlier, back in the early 30s, but the producer said to him, "Louis, we don't think the world is ready for Holy Roller Jazz." they were ready for it in 38, that's for sure.
We sure were. Jim, our next caller from Oshkosh. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to say that back in 1955 at Indiana University, Mr. Armstrong played at our military ball. It was quite a thrill for me because I had been a fan of his for a long time. And the interesting part was there wasn't a lot of dancing going on. We all just kind of hung around the stage and listened, and it was fantastic.
That sounds wonderful. You know, I never make a radio appearance without hearing from somebody who heard Armstrong live or met him, because lots of people have stories about going to get an autograph backstage and they end up having dinner with him. He was that kind of guy. He just made a permanent impression on people whenever they saw him.
He was such a hard worker. When I think about the grueling nature of, 300 days a year on the road, 300 days.
Yeah, at the end of his life, he told an interviewer, "I've blown my chops off." If you see a photograph, a close-up of his face, you can see what he's talking about, because his upper lip bears this really ugly, in certain lights, almost shocking scar, the scar of his trumpet embouchure, which was a little bit flawed. He used too much pressure, and so throughout his life, he had troubles with split lips.
So he never learned how to use the instrument properly?
Well, he didn't. But that's putting it a little too strongly. If you play like Louis Armstrong, you're playing the instrument
exactly,
properly.
Well, exactly. Exactly. But to not hurt yourself.
Yeah, his technique was flawed because he was not quite self-taught, but largely self-taught. He didn't have the kind of technical training that would have allowed him to play with less pressure. And by the time he was in a position to get that kind of training, his habits were set as a player. He also had a condition called leukoplakia, which causes the formation of excessive scar tissue. It's also the reason why his voice was so gravelly, because he developed nodes from scar tissue on the vocal cords. So that was a good thing. He was all for that, but the lip problems were simply something he had to live with from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks so much for your call. We go to Jan from North Freedom. Hi, Jan.
Oh, hi. This is Jan in North Freedom. Yes, I was just calling to, I did see Louis Armstrong live in probably 1965 in Madison.
Oh.
But I also have here an original first recording at 78 RPM of Louis Armstrong singing The Kiss of Fire. And I wondered if I could play a little bit of it. I know it would come through all right. Could I try that?
You can try it, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. If it doesn't work, though, we won't stay
with it. I know.
Okay.
We'll just give it a try.
Okay.
Now, here we go.
I touch your lips all at once, sparkle flying.
Are you hearing it okay?
Yes, we are.
Loud and clear.
Out of line, and though I see the danger still, flames go higher. I know I must surrender to your kiss of fire.
Isn't that awesome?
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
That's wonderful. Yeah, we enjoyed it. So
that's from the late 40s, early 50s, and Armstrong loved pop ballads as much as he loved playing and singing jazz. And especially when he signed with Decca Records, he recorded a lot of these just good old-fashioned pop tunes like Kiss of Fire. And you know, some people thought, he shouldn't be wasting himself on that kind of material. He would have responded to that with very sharp language, because he liked a good tune as much as the next guy. And this is one of those good tunes.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call, Jan. Our number is 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join the conversation. When we were on Eisenhower, I meant to ask you, the follow-up to that was when I believe it was the State Department wanted to send Louis Armstrong to the Soviet Union, and that's when a lot of his comments about, how can you, when he was critical of Eisenhower position on race. Whatever happened with that? What was the? Why did they want to send Louis Armstrong to the Soviet Union?
Well, in the mid late 50s, that was the beginning of cultural diplomacy with the United States, and the State Department felt quite rightly that to send Armstrong to Russia, which was well aware of American jazz, which was being broadcast by the Voice of America, so they knew exactly who Louis Armstrong was. They thought he would be the most powerful possible ambassador for American artistic freedom. And the trip, of course, fell through because when Armstrong made the statements about Little Rock, he said he wouldn't make a trip because how could he go abroad and have people asking him as an ambassador for the United States to explain this? But, of course, when Eisenhower changed his tune, it was too late to get the trip to Russia back on the stocks again. But Armstrong went to Europe as an official American cultural ambassador in 1960, and thereafter made many trips abroad representing the United States, not in an informal way as he had previously, but under the umbrella of the State Department.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the people he played with. He played with everyone, didn't he?
Just about. Made his first recordings with King Oliver, of course, in the 20s, his most celebrated musical partner was Earl Hines, the great jazz pianist, and at that time his close friend, who was as influential on piano as Armstrong was on trumpet. Later on, well, I mean, the list of people who went through Armstrong's bands is a list of some of the greatest figures in jazz. J.C. Higginbotham and Jack Teagarden, the great trombone players, Barney Bigard, Duke Ellington, solo clarinet player, Sid Catlett, I think the greatest drummer in jazz ever, was Armstrong's favorite drummer, and the list just goes on and on. And then the people he guested with, that list is even longer. He recorded very famously with Ella Fitzgerald, with Billie Holiday, with Oscar Peterson, with Dave Brubeck, one of his most beautiful later recordings. And then a great, great album in which Duke Ellington sits in on piano with Armstrong's group for a program of Ellington tunes. Mm. And that is the great album of Armstrong's later years, Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, The Great Reunion.
Mm. It must be one of the great albums of all time.
Yes.
Yeah. Dick is our next caller from Iowa. Hi, Dick. Hi, Dick. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Dick Rogensack from Waukon, Iowa. And I just wanted to tell you that when I was 17, that was in 1950, Louis Armstrong and his band came out from, they were playing at the Blue Note in Chicago. They weren't busy on Monday night, so they came out on the Zephyr and had a dance in the Opera House in Waukon.
Oh,
and
but that's just like Armstrong. He had one night off, so they hopped the train and did a one-nighter.
That's right. Uh-huh. And he was playing at the Blue Note at the time, and he came out on the Zephyr with his band. A guy in Waukon paid him $500. And I was 17. My future wife was 16. We got to go to the dance.
Oh.
And that was... I think we paid $25 a couple. It was just a wonderful night.
That sealed the romance, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting thing that you mentioned that, because we think of Armstrong in his later years as playing concert dates, but in fact, he loved to play for dancers. That's when he would trot out tunes that he didn't usually play at nightclubs or at concerts. He liked that just as much as he liked getting into the tuxedo and playing at Carnegie Hall. I can tell you that for sure.
Mm, that's a great story. Thank you, Dick, very much. We go next to Virginia from Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Hi.
Hi.
I wanted to tell you a sweet story. I had a Down syndrome sister who at about age 20 fell in love with Louis Armstrong. She called him Louis. And she loved to hear Hello, Dolly, and would sing along with it. And I was wondering, did he ever play in Milwaukee? Did he ever appear in Milwaukee?
Oh, yes. There weren't many cities where he didn't play. You know, a guy who played 300 nights a year, he pretty much made the rounds. But I do know that he came through Milwaukee more than once.
Thank you, Virginia, for your call. We go to Richard from Madison next. Hi, Richard.
Hi there. These are lovely stories, but what I'm curious about, without getting too technical, is how musically, sort of what was the most important things that, how he sort of furthered jazz, kind of moved things along?
Great.
Good question. To begin with, the sense of rhythm. Armstrong is the voice of mature jazz, modern jazz, who comes along ahead of his time and has a sense of swing unrivaled only by one other player in the early 20s, Sidney Bechet, who was his senior down in New Orleans. It was Armstrong who was more influential because his music was more widely circulated and because his personality was more attractive. But that ability to always be moving forward on the beat, that kind of energy, was a new thing in jazz, because if you listen to jazz recordings from the beginning in 1917 through the early 20s, they sound like jazz, but they don't have that modern sense of swing. And then Armstrong comes along. As soon as he starts making records, you hear that sense immediately from his first record in 1923 on. And as soon as people started hearing it, they said, well, we want to play like this. Beyond that, Armstrong is really the key figure in developing jazz as a solo music. Classic New Orleans music is an ensemble music. You don't have too many solos. You get people playing together, clarinet, trombone, trumpet. Armstrong, the first great virtuoso of jazz, along with Sidney Bechet, has a technique more highly developed than anybody who'd come before him, a more highly developed upper register, played those high notes. And after him, jazz becomes a music of soloists accompanied by rhythm sections and ensembles, rather than a music primarily dominated by the ensemble.
Oh, that's interesting.
And then there's also his singing. He was really the first great jazz singer, the person who showed everybody that you can improvise with the voice, that you can loosen up a melodic line, that you can sing the same way that you'd play. Or as he put it, he played the same way he sang. So I think those are the three key elements that make Armstrong the first great influence in jazz.
Thank you so much for the call. We haven't talked about his wives. Was he lucky in love?
The last time. He married four times. His first wife was a New Orleans prostitute, very logical since he spent most of his time playing in honky-tonks. They didn't get along too well. She tried to cut his throat one night.
Oh,
he was asking for it, too. He was cheating on her. Then he goes north, and he marries Lil Hardin, Lil Armstrong, as we now know her, the piano player in the Creole Jazz Band. And that was a rather stormy marriage, because Lil was a college-educated gal who had heirs. And Lewis said every time he sat down on the bed, she wanted to make it again. So they didn't get along too well. Then he married a chorus girl named Alpha, and she turned the tables and cheated on him. The last marriage was to a showgirl at the Cotton Club in New York, Lucille Wilson, and that one took. They got married, I think, in 40, 41, and they remained married to the end of his life. He wasn't always a faithful husband, as people who were out on the road as much as he was do sometimes stray. But he adored her, she adored him, they were determined to make it work, and they did.
We go to one more phone call. Karen from Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. I just want to tell about a memory 15 years ago when my husband and I were at a celebration of children who had received bone marrow transplants for leukemia and had survived at Children's Hospital. And the children and their donors walked around at the end of the celebration, a great big field. And the music that was playing when they were walking around, some of them were carrying the children on their backs, was It's a Wonderful World, sung by Louis Armstrong. I will never forget that. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there, not a dry eye.
Oh, I would imagine. And we're going to end our show actually with that song. Jim from Madison has emailed, little is known of his concern for the state of race relations, and I think that's one of the great contributions of Terry's book, because it's filled with his comments on this subject. In fact, he wrote and played the song What a Wonderful World, which is absolutely gorgeous. He was ahead of his time in music and awareness of the state of society, and I think that is very true. Terry, I love your book. It's just, I think it's wonderful, and thank you so much for this hour.
Well, I've so enjoyed talking to you and your callers about it. It's been a real pleasure.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Terry Teachout, drama critic of the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this program.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.